This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dave Richards says when you're investigating an avalanche that killed people, you have to begin by admitting you don't know what actually happened. Richards is the director of the avalanche office at ALTA. He was part of the team that explored the avalanche in Mill Creek Canyon on February 6th on a run called Wilson Glade. It killed 4 backcountry skiers. Richards compares the process of figuring out what happened to being at a crime scene.
So you're kind of being a detective. You're looking at what we call clues. Could be skis laying on the surface, gloves. Do those skis have skins on them or not? Who does this ski pole belong to? Avalanche flow is dictated by terrain. It moves as water would with the terrain in a fall line. So you're going, okay, this ski belongs to this person, which makes sense because this ski matches that ski, which is perhaps in the same hole as that person. You're putting that all together on the scene. And then you're looking at the tracks going into the avalanche and saying, okay, they were here, they were there. How did this go down? And that's when you start to get into interviewing survivors and witnesses, which is an incredibly difficult thing because these people have just been through a very traumatic event. And you got to ask hard questions. And that can be a very unpleasant job, to make someone cry and know that you're going to make them cry by recounting probably the worst day of their life. And when they tell you that story, people generally in the mountains want to tell you what happened because they want to know what went wrong. So we look at it and we say, okay, where did we go awry? And then what went awry next? Because it's never just a single event. It's always a series of events that take place that lead you to a tragic moment. You have to keep asking the same question over and over and over until you get to the details of what really went down so that we can actually learn from it.
Another deadly weekend on the slopes of Utah's mountains. 4 skiers were killed in an avalanche that officials say was triggered by 2 groups.
So in the Wilson Glade avalanche of February 6, 2021, 2 groups set out from different trailheads, one in Mill Creek Canyon outside of Salt Lake and one in Big Cottonwood Canyon. And one left the Butler Fork trailhead headed for Wilson Glade, and the other left the Alexander Basin trailhead headed for the same destination. On the way, both groups have told us they saw large natural avalanches. One of the groups, we'll call them Group A, actually posted a photo on Instagram of a large natural event right on the other side of Wilson Peak from where they were headed. And that group reached Wilson Glade far before the other group did. And they actually dropped in, they skied it. And they skied it once, and then they skied it again. And then one person stayed on the ridge while the other 4 in the group skied it a third time. And as the group of 4 was skinning back up and out of Wilson Glade, ascending to rejoin their single partner on the ridge, the second group, Group B, was entering the trees below them where they had found Group A's ascending track and were following it. And Group A reached a stand of trees just below the ridgeline and regrouped to discuss crossing it one at a time. And then as the first person stepped out onto the slope, in that moment, this person that stepped onto the slope turned and grabbed the tree behind him and was able to hang on as the snow moved by. And that's a horrible moment. That's a horrible sensation to realize that I either have to make the move of my life to grab this tree, or I am off for the ride of my life. And it's a very helpless feeling once you miss that tree. And I'm just very thankful that he got a hold of it. The entire world around you literally shatters. Everything is suddenly put in motion. It's kind of the sensation of when you put the car in reverse, but the car next to you is moving forward, and nothing makes sense for that split second. And in that split second, you suddenly realize you have to make some sort of life-saving move. But I think that the thing that's always stuck with me is after large avalanche events, the dead silence. At that point, I imagine your heart completely sinks. What's next?
For this young man clinging to the tree, now what? What happened? Tell me what he did.
First, he screamed for the assistance of his partner, which was still on the ridgeline. And he started a beacon search. He and his partner moved down slope where they had last seen their partners. And they moved downhill about 200 feet and they acquired a beacon signal. And they honed in on that beacon signal, and there were two signals side by side, which is makes a search very complicated. And they took their probes out, just the active sticking a long metal probe into the snow until you can feel a body. And they got a probe strike and they started digging. And they dug someone up. And they looked at him and they said, "Who are you?" And that's when it dawned on him that there was a second group involved. And they were able to extricate this young man. Then they moved on to the next signal and they dug this person up and they said, "Who are you?" And at this point, the clock is ticking. You only have about 15 minutes to survive buried under the snow. And they had two people out in about 20 minutes. And now we're looking at the clock as they move on from these two people who they've saved. And there's no question that they saved their lives, no questions asked. And they move on, you know, the next signal they acquire, which happens to be members of their group. And from there on out, they dig out four more people, all of which are deceased. So,
what is that like to frantically be digging and finding a body that's dead?
It's horribly, horribly, horribly defeating. We go to the mountains to find joy. And there's nothing fun about this. Everything that you thought was wonderful in your life all the sunrises, all the powder skiing, all the wonderful ski tour conversations just became the most horrible memories of your life. And it's deflating. It's defeating for people, and it makes people look very hard at themselves and very harshly at themselves, which isn't fair, and wonder, what did I do wrong? How did I get in this position where my partner or my wife or my girlfriend or my child just died in an avalanche? And it's brutal, and I've seen it beat people beyond return. In that very moment, I think the only thing that I can describe it as is defeat. And there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do.
How much do you need to know as someone who's now investigating something like this? How much do you need to know about snow science versus how much you need to know about human nature?
Well, you know, there's two problems in avalanches. One is the avalanche problem. And you have to investigate that, and you have to look at it, and you have to say, what kind of avalanche is it, and all this science stuff. But an avalanche problem doesn't exist without people. Avalanches have been happening since the beginning of time, since the first snowflake ever fell. And it wasn't until we added people to the equation that we actually had a problem. So there's two different things. And I would tell you the majority of what you need to know as you look at an accident is about people, our decision-making processes, our psyches, our emotions, our desires, you know. That's what causes avalanche accidents. If we remove people from the equation, then avalanche accidents don't exist. All that exists is avalanches, and nobody cares.
I want to know how it is you talk about something like this, where you're wanting to know what happened, and you may have to be critical, and you may have to second guess some of the decisions that were made. But then you also have to remember they're victims. There are people who died. This is still raw. Families are just coming to terms with this sense of terrible loss. I mean, how do you learn the lessons, investigate the lessons, but still try to remain empathetic and sensitive to what just happened?
You know, I think that comes from experience. Would you ever ask someone to investigate an aircraft accident that had never learned how to fly? And I think the way I come to it, and the way I look at accidents that I've investigated or accidents that I've responded to as a rescuer or accidents that I've just hemmed and hawed over for years is, okay, let's step back and let's understand, as a skier and as an avalanche person, how I would have gotten there. And if you understand how you got there in their shoes, then suddenly it becomes very easy to become empathetic. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I've skied this run that these people were killed on Wilson Glade in high hazard a number of times. I understand how they got there. I get it. And if you can look at it with those kind of eyes and say, I'm not here to be critical. I'm here to understand it, not as an investigator, not as a rescuer, not as a avalanche forecaster. I'm here to understand it as your counterpart in skiing. I get it. I know how you got there. Tell me what I can learn so that we can avoid this next time.
I want to ask if there's a lesson to be learned. I want there to be a lesson to be learned, but I don't know if there is. It sounds like there isn't just a clear lesson beyond never trust a faceted snowpack, right? Which just sounds like in the backcountry when you're dealing with snow on a mountainside, there's not necessarily a lesson, or maybe there is, but there's always going to be some kind of risk. How are you thinking about that finally?
So I guess here's the lesson that I've taken away from this accident and from many, many other events. Avalanches are a very difficult and at times an incredibly inexact science. And probably the best lesson that I've taken away and the best advice that I could give based on experience with looking at these things is to have the willingness to say, I don't know. If you can admit that, then you're forced to step back and look for answers in the most basic terms. And all of a sudden we're going back to that Instagram post looking for things we actually know, like, were there recent avalanches on similar terrain? And now you have concrete information that you can base a decision on. Literally three words. If you step back and say, I don't know, then you force yourself to answer questions instead of follow this overwhelming desire to ski powder. I'm most proud of the people in the world that say, I don't know.
Dave Richards is the director of the Avalanche Office at ALTA. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Is it plagiarism or simply efficient for state lawmakers to copy bills from other states? I'm Emily Means.
And I'm Sonia Hudson. 45 Days is KUER's politics podcast that dives into issues at the Utah legislature. This week, we're talking about bills that are taken almost word for word from other state legislatures.
Check out 45 Days wherever you listen to podcasts or go to 45days.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Dave Richards at ALTA told us this week there are avalanches running in the Wasatch Canyons this year that nobody has witnessed in their lifetimes. Little Cottonwood was closed for much of the week. Snow ran off the mountains, buried the road. The Utah Avalanche Center issued a forecast for the region that is very rare. Danger was at the level of extreme at every elevation and every aspect of mountain terrain. Today in the program, we're talking about avalanches in the West, not just how they work, because the people who make forecasts will tell you only part of this is about snow science. You always have to take into account the human factor. We reached out this week to Sarah Carpenter. She teaches with the American Avalanche Institute in Jackson, Wyoming. You don't think of an avalanche as having a character, do you? Like a personality. And I wonder if like it's that if it's too much anthropomorphism, or is it helpful to think of them in that way as having this kind of list of characteristics and they're all different? Do you think of them as in that way?
It's a good question. It's an interesting way to think about it. I think of that a bit in terms of we talk about it as avalanche problems in the world of snow and avalanches. So I think you do see different characteristics when you have an avalanche that involves just the new snow, the storm snow, or when you have an avalanche that involves old layers, which we call a persistent slab problem. So I do think they have different characteristics and react differently depending on how that particular avalanche problem is formed.
I've heard you describe yourself as a storyteller. So when you're conveying information, when you're talking about risk, when you're talking about even snow science with people who don't know or just learning, talk about the storytelling part of that, and how much distance do you have to keep from making an avalanche seem like this big evil creature and making people take it seriously, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think how we as humans connect with the natural world is through stories. And for me, when I think about trying to educate people in the world, you know, around backcountry travel and around snow and avalanches, if we can tell those stories of accidents, near misses, if we can tell stories of how we interpret the signs of the natural environment, I think that that hopefully brings this abstract concept of what avalanches really are into a more concrete way of thinking. Hmm.
What is an avalanche? Like, how does it work? How does an avalanche work?
You know, when you hear people talk about avalanches, most of the time what we're talking about are slab avalanches. Yeah. And what a slab avalanche is it's a cohesive unit of snow that's sitting on some other snow grain that's just not as strong. And so what happens is you put more load on the snowpack via more snowfall, wind, people, and the layer underneath that cohesive unit of snow fails. Mm. And then that big slab goes moving down the slope. And so in order to have a slab avalanche, you need a slab, yeah. You need a weak layer. You need something for it to slide on, which can be the ground or another snow layer. And then you need terrain that's steep enough to slide. So terrain that's 30 degrees and above.
Is it a little bit like when you're making pizza and you put cornmeal down to get the dough to slide? Is it like that?
Yeah, it can be that much of a difference, that cornmeal and then some sort of, you know, and then the dough. It can be more subtle differences when we're thinking about storm slab avalanches, avalanches that occur just from the snowfall from the sky, where a storm starts out really cold and you get that really light, fluffy, low density snow, and then it warms up and that cold snow can form a weak layer. But this year in Utah, it is exactly that. Cornmeal on the bottom and then the pizza. Or the way I think of it is, this winter we're trying to build a house on a foundation of sand.
Yeah.
Right, the foundation of the snowpack is really weak this year.
So that's what defined what happened at that Wilson Glade avalanche that killed those four skiers in that first week of February. It was determined by the quality of the snow from earlier in that season, I guess.
Yeah, that's part of what happened, because, you know, this season there was early season snowfall, yeah, and then most of the storms missed Utah. You got a couple inches here, a couple inches there, but really you just had early season snow that sat around on the ground. And when snow just sits on the ground, it just gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And so it goes from being snow that you can form a snowball with to snow that feels like sand or feels like sugar. And then you put a big load of snow on top of that. So we put the house on a really weak foundation that couldn't hold up that load.
Are some avalanches more violent than others, more intense, you know, faster than others? Or is there always just something common about the physics when tons and tons of snow are giving way to gravity?
I mean, they all have that commonality of tons of snow giving way to gravity. I think what we're seeing this winter, especially, is in a lot of places around the U.S., we started out with this really weak foundation. Yeah. And when you have that problem, it's a harder avalanche problem to forecast for. And so what I mean by that is it's not as predictable as to where you're going to trigger an avalanche or potentially how big that avalanche will go. And so we have conditions in Utah and in Colorado and in Montana that we haven't seen as backcountry travelers in 20 years. And so if you've been backcountry skiing or snowmobiling for 10 years, these are conditions you've never seen before, which makes it really hard to safely navigate unless you're going back to your very foundational knowledge.
How much do you think about the human dynamic? Clearly, that's part of the way you think about all of this, of course. And one of the things you've described it as that level of uncertainty or the way the human factor plays into all of this. I think you've described it as voodoo magic. Would you talk a little bit about that? What do you mean by the voodoo magic piece that you work into the equation for all of this?
Well, when I think about snow science, I always describe it as part science and part voodoo magic, in that, you know, we're operating in this medium that's very close to its triple point, where it could be a solid, a liquid, and a gas. So it changes all the time. And so
super dynamic, right?
It's super dynamic. Yeah, yeah. And so that's what I think about with, you know, we have these tools of how to interpret stability and how to understand, you know, what the avalanche conditions are. But we also are operating in this environment where we don't always get good, accurate feedback. There are times where we ski a slope and it was unstable, but we got away with it.
Yeah.
We didn't hit the weak spot. And so, you know, when I think about operating in the backcountry, you don't always get good feedback. You don't, it's not like you're going bowling and when you throw a bad ball, it goes right in the gutter and you know you need to adjust.
Yeah.
When you're out in backcountry skiing, sometimes you just get away with things. And so you don't always know that you need to error correct or that you are really close to the line.
Well, I'm thinking about those Wilson Glade skiers who were caught in that avalanche. They had already been down and back up and down and back up and down and were back up, ready to go down again. So I guess you can't ever be totally sure that an avalanche, like, why did it go after the third run?
Yeah. And that's, we don't have a perfect answer. It's likely that they hit that weak spot, on that fourth ascent or third or fourth ascent. And that's that mysterious part. And so, you know, in seasons like this where avalanche forecasters are telling us, hey, this is a really unusual season, this is a really complex snowpack, you know, what we as backcountry travelers can do is go back to our foundational knowledge. And if there's one thing that I need to know as a backcountry traveler, it's how to recognize avalanche terrain and know, am I in avalanche terrain? Am I attached to avalanche terrain? And if I can, this season, oftentimes just be an avalanche terrain avoider, then that might be a way, you know, to a safer season.
You've said you have to build margin is how you've put
it.
What do you mean?
I mean that if you make a mistake, it's not catastrophic. And I think that can be hard to do when we're out in the backcountry. I mean, the terrain that avalanches is terrain that's 30 degrees and steeper. And if you're skiing or riding at a ski area, that's your advanced terrain or intermediate to advanced terrain. And so that's the terrain that the more skilled you are as a skier or a rider or a snowmobiler, that's the terrain that you're pulled to. So, you know, it's that tricky piece of wanting to go and travel in terrain that's really fun. But, you know, this year, recognizing that we have unusual conditions and recognizing that you want to set up a situation where even if you make a mistake, it's not the deadly mistake, right? And it's hard to do.
Yeah.
You know, I think people in the avalanche industry have, a lot of us have had close calls, and it can be really easy to misjudge how steep terrain is or the consequence of terrain if you're not getting those results. So
I wanted to ask you about a close call that you had that you've talked about. I think this was in the Tetons, and you were skiing with another woman, and you've talked about the experience as you both had a feeling, but you never, for whatever, I can't tell if it was peer pressure or what it was, but you decided not to talk to each other about it. Would you say something about that experience?
It is one of the more profound experiences I've had in the backcountry. This was many years ago, and it was rare that I got to go into bigger terrain with other women. I feel like that industry, you know, we're seeing more and more women in the backcountry, but, you know, 6, 7, 10 years ago, it felt like a rarity.
Yeah.
And so neither of us wanted to ruin the day. And so we would pause and sort of poke at the snow and look at each other and then keep pushing on. And in hindsight, when we debriefed the accident, we both said, yeah, I would never have been there with my regular ski partners. So it was this piece of like, oh, I don't love this, but I don't want to disappoint this other person. And the impact of that experience, I feel lucky that I survived the avalanche that I got caught in. And for me, the impact has been anytime I'm with a new partner, the first time I go out in the backcountry with them, I go to low consequence, high margin terrain. So I choose to travel in non-avalanche terrain, or, you know, on the very low end of avalanche terrain with a new partner before I go up into the high peaks. Because in this case, she had taken an avalanche course from us, but we had never recreated together. And we jumped into this big committing piece of terrain. And so my motto right now, it might sound flippant, but I like the motto of just try before you buy. Yeah. Of I want to figure out if we can communicate well and if we work together well before I enter bigger terrain with someone.
I guess this goes without saying that even though you have the snow science down, even though you've gone through what you've described as this recipe for risk, there's always going to be an element of uncertainty. Is there always going to be? When you go into the backcountry, some kind of risk, and you just have to determine what's acceptable?
Yeah, I mean, there is an element of uncertainty in that, you know, avalanche forecasting is not a perfect science. Yeah. And, you know, we don't always get that feedback. And I think you can manage for that uncertainty in large part based on your terrain selection. Because if we are in terrain that's 25 degrees, that's not attached to anything that's steeper, that's not going to avalanche. So we can pretty confidently recreate in that terrain. But if you're choosing to enter avalanche terrain, yes, there is an element of uncertainty.
Why do you do it? Why do you go into the backcountry?
You know, for me, traveling in the mountains, there is just this special connection of being in the mountains and being somewhere quiet and exploring new places. And that reward of moving through beautiful places, skiing beautiful powder, there is something to that reward that I keep coming back to. But I will say this winter, what for me, I have felt like between COVID and work being busy, I've felt like, okay, my brain is pretty full. Mm. And so what I have done is sort of narrowed my terrain selection this winter and taken a step back to, again, just that's the way that this winter I have been building margin for myself and for my ski partners is here's what I have capacity for. And, you know, those bigger pieces of terrain, maybe they come this spring if my brain is less full, or maybe they come next year, or maybe they come in 3 years. And taking a little longer view of my backcountry career.
Sarah Carpenter, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Carpenter, she's a co-owner of the American Avalanche Institute in Jackson, Wyoming. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
The University of Utah's U Giving Day is February 23rd and 24th. It's a day to support the critical work happening on campus, including KUER's mission to foster the next generation of audio storytellers. Your gift in support of KUER will fuel professional opportunities, training, and more for students and early career journalists. Show your support for education in the classroom and on the airwaves on U Giving Day. Go to KUER.org/UGivingDay.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the history and the science of avalanches, and not just how they work, but if you're forecasting them or investigating them or contemplating going into the backcountry, you have to add into the equation something as dynamic as the avalanche itself, the human factor. We also reached out to Drew Hardesty this week, who knows the Utah backcountry as well as anyone in this state. He's an avalanche forecaster with the Utah Avalanche Center. Put this time right now in context for us. Like, for those of us who don't go into the backcountry, who don't know that much about the history of all of this stuff, but yet we're seeing the headlines. Mm-hmm. What kind of a big deal is this? How different is this? How rare is this moment?
For this year in particular, I would say that we view it as this perfect confluence of many factors that are coming to play here. We, you know, first of all, looking at the snowpack in particular, you know, it's so dry early on. And when we have such a thin early snowpack, that starts to create really weak snow on the ground. You know, it has all the consistency and strength of like rock salt or house of cards. And then what we've done essentially in the last 4 to 6 weeks, Doug, is we've really added, you know, 60 to 80 to 100 inches of snow on top of that. And it's like, it's sort of like taking that house of cards that sits on the table, throwing the dictionary on top, tilting it up, and then knocking the legs out from underneath all at the same time.
Do you think, Drew, that this season is going to be defined by those early season conditions? That is, can you ever go back now? Like what's going on right now, even though there's tons of snow out there right now, we're going to be defined by that weak, crummy stuff in the beginning of the season. Is that right?
Yes, I would say short-term pain, long-term gain. You know, as they said 70 years ago, back when they were first, you know, researching snow and avalanches up at Alta, you know, in the 40s, you know, the snow doesn't like rapid change. And we have seen a lot of rapid change in the last week alone, Doug. But the long-term gain, what we are hopeful for in the forecasting world is that this amount of snow is going to help to overall stabilize and keep skiers essentially on top of the greatest snow on earth rather than being able to trigger it, because the weak layers by and large are going to be buried so much more deeply. Now, once we get to the spring and you start to see a lot of that snow melt and that free water percolating down to that old weak basal snow, all bets are off, and we may see full depth avalanches again come spring.
I want to ask you about the dynamic that seems the most mystifying, and that is the human factor. How much, and this was a question I was asking of Dave earlier, how much do you need to know about snow science versus the part that you need to know about the way humans behave? It seems like the human part, at least when you're talking about trying to prevent deaths from avalanches, it's the human part that you really seem to have to understand.
That's something that we have really taken a hard look at in the last 10 to 15 years. But more globally, Doug, I think that the key point when you're looking at risk is that for there to be risk, there has to be something that assumes risk, like people, infrastructure, roads, because if there's none of that, then sure, you can have avalanches, you know, that rip out trees and so forth. But without people and infrastructure, then there really is no risk. And I had no idea 21 years ago getting into avalanche forecasting, you know, as a snow scientist and as a backcountry skier and mountaineer, that I would become many things. I would need to become a marketing expert, a storyteller, a forensic scientist. In many ways, we're selling something. And how do you get people to buy what you're selling if you're selling safety? And it gets into so much of like psychology and behavioral economics to try to get people to buy what you're selling.
So one of the things you have compared it to, or is at least talked about, is it's like going to Vegas, I suppose. and how it is that – why it is that people do it, because they always know the house is going to win, right? But people still do it because there is that chance. Yet we're – as humans, we're really – we're not great at making rational decisions all the time. Mm-hmm. So how are you thinking about that part?
Yeah, that's really gets at the heart of it, I think, Doug, is, you know, I mean, cities like Las Vegas exist because we as humans, we are really bad at probabilities. We look at death and dismemberment as this esoteric idea that we really can't internalize those things until maybe it's too late. You know, the old saying, the subconscious mind does not know death. And so how can we understand it, these consequences, the outcomes, because we've never experienced these things before? And that way of powder skiing and riding, there's just like the greatest joy and ecstasy in the world. And we've never died in an avalanche before. And so we keep doing it.
There's this great avalanche forecaster, I'm sure you know, Ian McCammon, and mechanical engineer. And a couple of years ago, I wanted to, maybe to talk about this. He writes this really important paper. This was, I think, back in like 2002, where he takes all of these reports from like 700 avalanche incidents over the last 30 years. And he starts to develop what he described as these heuristic traps, the traps that people fall into when they're making these decisions. So he's trying to get people like yourself who go into the backcountry, who have to forecast avalanches, to take into account the human factor. What did we learn from Ian McCammon, I guess? And what are the traps? You don't need to get specific about all of them, but what are the traps that people are falling into, and how important was Ian McCammon's work in all of this?
Doug, I would say it was really a watershed moment for us to understand in part, what are these patterns that we're seeing when backcountry skiers and riders are making mistakes in there, maybe in spite of themselves, you know, where intelligence and IQ, I mean, they matter very little to the whole game in that way. And so in looking back at all of these avalanche accidents, Ian McCammon was able to tease apart and find some commonalities and patterns. And he describes them with an acronym of FACETS, F-A-C-E-T-S. And they are these landmines or obstacles that we trip over when we're making these subjective decisions to just dive into the steep slope. And familiarity would be the first one. Familiarity is that we are so familiar with the terrain and the conditions by and large that we tend not to look at the snowpack and the terrain with beginner eyes in that way, and just asking very simple questions. Maybe we've never seen something avalanche here before, and so our familiarity can sometimes get the best of us.
Talk about acceptance, the A part of the facets.
Well, it's a funny thing. I mean, these facets, Doug, are not unique to the avalanche game.
And yeah.
We tend, as social creatures, want to be accepted by the other people in our backcountry party or the greater avalanche community or the mountaineering community. And so we feel like we need to move through this world in ways that we think other people will accept us into their group. And we trip over that and get involved in avalanches.
Why is it that, and tell me if this is true, because some recent studies have found that the more you know about avalanches, the more likely you are to die. What does that mean? That doesn't, having all of this knowledge, I don't know if it's fair to say it doesn't protect you, but I found that really interesting, that the more you knew, the more exposed you might be as well. To help me understand that.
Yes, there could be quite a wide gap between, as I would put it, knowledge and wisdom, knowledge and the application of same. We can have all of the knowledge in the world, but then how do we make our decisions based upon the facts and the knowledge that we have out there? And, you know, again, McCammon gets at this with our personal disaster flags or pitfalls, where even despite all the obvious red flags, we tend to make bad decisions anyway. Now, there's another part of that, in my view, is that it's like, how do we use the knowledge? And as we have found in many cases, the more people learn about snow and snow metamorphism and the shapes and the sizes and the temperatures and the densities, they can tend to use this information to substantiate the decision to ski it or ride it rather than look at it as a way to avoid the avalanche terrain altogether. And so that, that sort of the overconfidence in that way can really get at it. The old joke here is like in a room full of experts, how do you know who is the false master? And the answer is they'll tell you. What I'm getting at is that there are no avalanche experts out there. We need to approach the backcountry and the snowpack with a great deal of humility because there's always a great deal of uncertainty when looking at the snowpack.
You were caught up in an avalanche. How much do you talk about that? How much do you think about that? Because I just wonder about the trauma of the experience, but also how it informs the way you think about all of this.
Any actuary will tell you that if you're driving long enough, you're bound to be involved in an automobile accident. Now, you're probably not going to be killed, but you're probably going to be involved somehow in an avalanche. And so in that way, if you're looking at avalanche forecasters and guides and ski patrollers, it's just the environment in which we operate that you're bound to be involved in a fender bender over the course of your 25 or 30 year career. I've written about this a great deal in the past about how shame is something that can destroy the community. In fact, our reputations are built over a 30 year career, but they can seemingly be destroyed overnight. But the culture has changed a great deal in the last 15 years, Doug.
For the better.
Oh, yeah, 100 times over.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be that, you know, 15 years ago, if you were involved or had a close call with an avalanche, that many people would really keep that tight and wouldn't want to tell anything to the community about this close call. But I've argued that leadership begins at the top. And if we as avalanche professionals can detail our close calls and near misses, that does two things. Essentially, what it does is that it allows people to understand, A, while conditions are really dangerous, we probably ought to take two steps back from the ridge. And B, by modeling openness and transparency and communication. And I think that really strengthens the bonds within the community.
What's so great about this? What's so great about going into the backcountry and skiing in that snow? Why take the risk? Lots of people are, I'm sure, listening right now are mystified by that. Like, I'm sure it's great skiing, but is it that great?
Yes, Doug. There will always be people that wonder, you know, how could people assume these risks? But there's just something in our DNA, Doug. They're all the same reasons of like, why did we come across the land bridge, you know, those many years ago? Why did we go to the moon? Why does Chuck Yeager break the sound barrier? You know, it's all the same reason. It's the joy and fulfillment of life. And we all receive that joy and fulfillment in different ways. And, you know, in the way of powder skiing and riding, Doug, it's almost like the closest thing we get to flying in this world. But there's something more than that. There's a bit of a thrill when you are putting yourself out there and you know that there are stakes involved or there are consequences involved, that, you know, there's something where the outcome is unknown. It's just sort of how many of us are built. And I think that's why we go into the backcountry.
One of the things that Dave Richards told us was that he didn't think we'll ever get this just right. When you're trying to assess risk, when you're trying to understand the snow science, when you're trying to make sense of the human factor, that you never just quite get it right. He said, I have to fix the people, but that's impossible. I'll never understand the snow science completely because an avalanche will do what an avalanche will do. What do you make of that? How do you respond to that sort of futility? Because it seems like that's a constant in the work you do.
Yes, Dave Richards is spot on with that assessment, Doug. You know, it's really easy to forecast terrain. You know, it's all physics. You know, most avalanches occur on 30 to 45 degree slopes in the backcountry, you know, predominantly north through east facing and so on and so forth. Forecasting snow is sometimes challenging and unpredictable, but forecasting people, I mean, that's the impossible. Having said that, I would say that if you look at the trends in fatalities over the last 20 to 25 years, Doug, our average number of fatalities have either flatlined or diminished a bit. And that's in spite of the exploding and skyrocketing numbers of people heading off into the backcountry in the mountains. And we feel pretty good about that. I think that's a good sign that people are learning about avalanches. They are taking Beacon Shovel Probe into the backcountry. They are going to the avalanche forecast in the morning to arm themselves with the weapon of knowledge, as we say. I think these are all really things to be proud of.
Drew Hardesty, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Drew Hardesty, he's an avalanche forecaster with the Utah Avalanche Center. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.